This is London Calling.
This week is the anniversary of a concert that was the most ambitious international satellite television venture that had ever been attempted at the time, Live Aid. My guest is a bloke who had a very important job on that day, Trevor Dann.
A Status Quo came on and started up with Rocking All Over the World. I kid you not, Richard and I embraced and cried because we were so nervous and so tired because the whole thing had taken so much. I can't remember exactly, but I think we'd had something like 2 months to set the whole thing up. And a lot of people had been involved. A lot of people worked a lot harder than I did, but we were all exhausted. And my word, it was really emotional. I have to say, I've never cuddled Richard Skinner since and have no plans to do so.
I'm Graham Mack, and more from Trevor Dann later. He not only talks about Live Aid, but he also talks about making one of my favourite radio programmes of all time. But first, in America, you call it a costume party. In Britain, it has the quaint title of a fancy dress party. And my wife has to go to work in fancy dress. She works in a shop and they're having a wild themed evening and sale. So she has to go dressed as a leopard, which, while she's in the environment of the fancy dress, is fine, but you've got to get to and from a fancy dress event, and that's where the fun starts. Julie's from New Zealand. Daphne, you're from New Zealand as well, and you live in London too. You ever been to a fancy dress party?
Yeah, quite a few times.
Yeah, was there ever an incident at the party, or maybe on the way there or on the way home?
Well, we drank too much and we puked up in someone's car.
Oh, dear. And what were you dressed as?
As a Maori.
You were dressed as a Maori, were you? Were you really? Right, you were the puking Maori.
Yeah. And we had too much to drink.
Yeah.
We tried to show a good impression, but it didn't work.
No.
We puked up in their car.
No, you weren't. No, you weren't doing much for the image of the indigenous population either, were you? You know, you when you dress as a Maori, it's quite a responsibility. You're an ambassador for a whole people.
I know.
Yeah, you really let the side down there.
Good job I wasn't at home.
Yeah. I don't know. Puking up in someone's car, I think that's worse than puking up at home. Yeah.
No, but I mean...
This wasn't in New Zealand, that's what you're saying.
No, it was here.
It was in Britain, yeah. Oh, in New Zealand, I think it would have been frowned upon.
That's right.
Yes, it would, yeah. All right. My wife's going back. She's going a week on Monday. She's going to New Zealand to visit her mum for her birthday.
Oh, is she? Is she a Māori or is she...
No, she's Pākehā. Her parents are from Wales. They emigrated in 64. Oh. Julie was born in 68.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that'd be lovely for her.
Yeah, she can't wait.
I bet.
Yeah, because...
My parents died some time ago, but I got 22 brothers and sisters.
You got 22 brothers and sisters?
Yeah, my mum had 22 children.
What?
Yeah.
Did you all live in a shoe?
Well, in the toilet at the back, I think, in the garden. Well, and then I'm the only one out of the whole lot of us who's got under 10 children.
Wow. You see, you're a Catholic family.
No, we're Methodist.
Well, you've really got that method down.
Yes.
The royal family, they're not good value for money. They don't bring any money into this country, but they cost us around £345 million a year. We keep getting fed the bull that the royals bring in tourists. They don't. Most tourists who visit Britain never see a royal. Oh, they see palaces and castles, but not royals. And they'd visit the palaces and castles anyway if we didn't have a monarchy. France hasn't had a monarch since 1870, and more than 3 million people visit the Palace of Versailles every year. And never mind the major royals. Why is our tax money being used to pay for the minor royals. Why are we spending millions of pounds on Catherine Wolseley, the Duchess of Kent? Or Marie von Reibnitz, Princess Michael of Kent? When public services are being squeezed and cut, the state has a duty of care to the most vulnerable in our society. We shouldn't be giving handouts to rich people. And the palace is totally unaccountable. It's able to operate with a far greater degree of secrecy than any other part of the state. And it's also got considerable lobbying clout within the government. That's why the government hasn't cracked down on royal spending. The monarchy has never been funded like any other public body, which are usually set an annual budget based on what they actually need to spend. Until 2013, the cost of the monarchy, that's the Queen in her role as head of state, and the other working royals, were funded by a civil list payment and a number of separate grants covering travel, property maintenance, communications and other expenses. All these costs have now been rolled into a single annual payment called the Sovereign Grant, and this has been set at 25% of the surplus revenue from the Crown Estate, which is a publicly owned property portfolio. And that meant that this year they got a payment of £76.1 million. But the Sovereign Grant is just one part of the total cost of the monarchy. The royal family's security bills picked up by the Metropolitan Police, and royal visits are paid for by local councils. Meanwhile, incomes from the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall, despite belonging to the nation, that money goes directly to the Queen and Prince Charles. According to the website Republic, when all of these hidden costs are included, the real cost of the monarchy to the British taxpayer is around £345 million a year. So the monarchy is expensive. Very expensive. Of course, it wouldn't matter if it was free. The cost to our democracy would still be too high. Talking about fancy dress stories, Mick, you and a load of mates decided it was a fancy dress thing, and what did you decide to go as?
Yeah, we all decided to go as Sugar Plum Fairies.
And this is all blokes, is it?
Yeah, there's about five blokes.
Yeah.
And one of our mates is about 6 foot four and he's built like a bus. He's massive, like, full of tattoos.
Yeah.
And we all decided to do the old Only Fools and Horses trick. And we decided not to turn up at this fancy dress thing as fancy dress. And he was the only one who turned
up. He was the only one dressed as a fairy.
We all waited around the door. We told all our mates, obviously, what he was going to do. And
yeah.
He got out of a taxi and he was all laughing as he walked down towards this... It's like a school. We went to a school disco thing, and we told him it was fancy dress.
And it wasn't. So no one was in fancy dress. Everyone was just in like school uniform type outfits.
Yeah, we just turned up normal.
Oh, you turned up normal, and he's dressed as a fairy. Did he have a wand and everything?
He had the wand. He had the wings and everything. He had tattoos all down his arms, and he walked in, and I told everyone that what he was going to do. So
yeah.
Everyone was expecting him, and then we all turned the music off as he walked in the door, and it was like surprise.
Let's get to this week's guest. Trevor Dann is a British writer and broadcaster who's been associated with some of the most influential radio and television music programmes and events of the last 30 years. On the 13th of July 1985, 72,000 people were inside Wembley Stadium in London. 1.9 billion people in 150 countries were watching worldwide on TV. It was a concert called Live Aid to raise money for people starving in Ethiopia. I asked Trevor, what was his job on the day?
Well, my job was looking after the television presentation in between the acts. So I was taking a brief rest from real work in radio and working in television at the time on the dark side. And we had got what we used to call the Jimmy Hill box. It was the controller box that hung from the ceiling of Wembley Stadium, where the commentators used to sit for big matches. This is, of course, the old Wembley. And you used to have to scramble up these stairs, metal stairs, to get to it. And we had to bring guests up in between the bands to fill while, you know, we talked to them about this, that and the other, and asked them to send money and so on. So my job was to corral these people and be, in effect, a sort of studio producer of the television stuff, the interstitial material, if you like, in between the bands.
And you were responsible for the intro, which wasn't as planned.
No, the introduction was an interesting time and possibly the scariest thing that I've ever had to do, because it was just literally seconds before the whole beginning sequence, which, as you can imagine, was fairly well kind of planned, that Mike Appleton, the exec producer, came on the headphones and said, "The Prince and Princess of Wales haven't arrived yet. So can you start the show from the box?"
So the original plan was?
The original plan was that Tommy Vance, who was on the stage, would say something, and then the Prince and Princess of Wales would arrive, and then Status Quo would play, and then we would speak. But for some reason, this couldn't happen. And so they said to us, "Look, you'll have to launch the show for the world." And so I remembered, I don't know why, that old two-way family favourite show that I grew up with, you know, in the 1950s on the radio.
Now, there'll be a lot of people listening to this in the United States.
Right.
Just explain what two-way family favourites is.
Two-way family favourites was a show for servicemen and military people abroad serving the British Empire, old boy. And it was a way of them being able to send requests back to home and for family and friends at home to send requests to them. And it was presented partly from London and partly from Cologne in what was then West Germany, which was really at the centre of the kind of British Army of the Rhine, the army of post-war occupation in Germany. And they used to start the show every week. It was 12 o'clock in London. And they used to say, "It's 12 noon in London, 1 o'clock in Germany, and at home and away, it's time for two-way family favourites." And off would come the tune, you know. And so I just grabbed this pad on the day of Live Aid and wrote, "It's 7 a.m. in Philadelphia, 12 noon in London, and around the world, it's time for Live Aid." And I just gave it to Richard Skinner. And Skinner and I had known one another for quite a long while because we worked together at Radio 1. And I'd brought him into Whistle Test, the TV show I was doing, to do some bits and bobs. And he's a very skilled presenter, very calm, which was, my God, necessary, because we had some other presenters who would have utterly panicked. And I gave him this script, and within, you know, seconds, they cued us. And so Richard said, there was a pause, and then Richard said, it's 7 a.m. in Philadelphia." And as he was starting to speak, the huge PA system came on, and you could feel the box that we were in rattling, you know. And it was a huge shock to suddenly hear, you know what it's like as a broadcaster. You're used to hearing yourself in your headphones. But if there's the slightest delay, it's slightly off-putting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there was poor old Richard hearing himself back with, it was only a millisecond delay, but it was a delay. But he, my word, what a trooper. He kept going.
"It's 12 noon in London, 7 a.m. in Philadelphia. And around the world, it's time for Live Aid."
A Status Quo came on and started up with Rocking All Over the World. I kid you not, Richard and I embraced and cried. We were all exhausted. And my word, it was really emotional.
Here we go, what a morning, we're hitting the road, here we go.
have to say I've never cuddled Richard Schooner since and have no plans to do so. You know, a lot of crap is talked about how, you know, we all got together and worked as a team and it was very smooth and all the rest of it. Well, no, it wasn't really. A lot of us didn't think it would happen. You know, I happened to be in the office when Bob Geldof rang up and said, we're thinking of doing this thing. And I pretty much said, well, you know, chance to be a fine thing, Bob, you know, kind of, I don't think you'll pull this off. And because I knew him from various things that I'd done in the past at the BBC, particularly at Radio 1. And I was very sceptical. Not cynical, although I may have sounded it. But I was sceptical that they could pull it together. And of course, the story was, briefly, that Bob had gone to Tyne Tees Television, where his then wife, Paula, worked doing the famous TV show The Tube. And said to Malcolm Gerry and the others, I'm going to do this big show. And Malcolm looked at the available resources and said, of course we'd love to help, but only the BBC has enough trucks and enough kit and enough engineers to put on a thing like this. So Bob came to the BBC with some reluctance, really. And I thought that the BBC would say, well, that's a nice idea, you know, you bolshy Irishman, and pat him on the head and send him away. But in fact, you know, and I've said this before and I do still believe this, I think the unsung hero of Live Aid is Michael Grade, who went on to be, you know, big cheese at the at ITV and of course the BBC. And at the time, he was the director of television, so he's in charge of radio of BBC One and BBC Two, the two main TV channels. And it was Michael who said, this is a really good thing and we should clear all the schedules. And that was a big move, you know, because you can imagine the BBC's got contracts with people, you know, to take off a programme that you've already paid for or that you will have to pay for whenever. It is a costly and brave decision. And he not only took that decision, but entrusted BBC One prime time for hours on end to a bunch of people who basically could just about make a 40-minute show for BBC Two in the evening, which was the Yale Grey Whistle Test team. And my God, you know, it was hard to get it right. And of course, if you watch it back now, that's why so much of it is in fact shite. We just weren't good enough to do a lot of it well. And some of the TV coverage is just dreadful. I've since heard back quite a lot of the radio coverage, which I wasn't involved with, which is much better. There's no doubt that the radio boys had a much greater facility for it because they knew what they were doing. We'd never done a live show. We'd certainly never done anything remotely as challenging as this. So it was a bit odd to ask us to do it, but you know, we soldiered on.
You say bits of it were shite, but it was BAFTA award winning shite.
Well, I think
the BAFTA is the equivalent of the Oscar.
The BAFTA is the equivalent of the Oscar.
And you won one.
Well, I didn't personally win one. The team won one, and so we all got to troop up there and shake hands. I think we won it for ambition and scale. And because it was a defining moment in all sorts of things, I think nothing that big had been tried on the television. That's why it won that award. I happen to think that it was a defining moment culturally and certainly musically as well. But I think it won an award because it was big. Certainly not because it was any good. If you ever get a chance to watch Andy Kershaw interviewing John Hurt, the actor, when he plainly doesn't know who the hell he is, that's that's one of the great
Kershaw
highlights.
Kershaw doesn't know who John Hurt is.
John
Hurt doesn't know who Andy Kershaw is.
Andy Kershaw doesn't know who John Hurt is.
Oh, because the other way round could be forgiven.
Yes, I'd definitely be forgiven.
You don't know what's going on, eh? I'm joined now. I know it's the norm in this box to be joined by lots of men in sheepskin coats who'll say it's all about 90 minutes and it was a 50-50 ball. I'm pleased to say on this occasion, I'm joined by actor John Hurt, star in 1984 and lots of other films. Who are you most wanting to see here today?
Who would I most wanted to see?
You're a rock fan, aren't you? Hey, you're in the wrong place if you're not.
I love it, but it's on a day like today, it's not a matter of I want to see any particular band. I want to see them all.
Yeah? You're just here to soak up the whole event?
Yeah, the whole event. The whole event is such a huge event. There's never been an event like it in the world before, ever. And that's quite a big statement.
If I can suddenly turn you into a spokesman for the acting profession for a minute, as a famous actor, is there a feeling amongst actors to do something similar, to make a similar contribution to what the rock stars have done?
I think there would be. I think that the feeling amongst actors is that it's somewhat more, it's a little bit more hopeless insofar as that it doesn't have the popular, the popular backing that you get with a show like the show with bands. If you could be sure of being able to put a film together or something which was going to
profit from which you go to.
The only difficulty with films is you never know whether it's going to make any money anyway.
Right, I'll do it. I'll have to interrupt you, John, because I've got to say, about to take the stage is a man who's widely believed to be my brother, and I'd like to take this opportunity on worldwide television to deny this. Oh, I'm told we've got to hold it now. Oh, quick, this air is coming on. Run VT.
Live from London with BBC TV.
There was a lot of that. People were being trooped up into the box and we were being told to interview them. And we had no time because there's no green room, there's no talk back. So we had no time to prepare the presenters. And anyway, they were under a phenomenal amount of pressure. You know, Kershaw had done a bit of Radio 1. David Hepworth, you know, he was an experienced presenter of a pre-recorded television show.
Mm. And short interviews.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, was a great journalist, still is, you know, as was and is Mark Ellen, the other major presenter. But it was interesting that actually the best presenter on Live Aid was Mike Smith, who just had the chops. You know, he'd just done all that stuff. He'd done looking at the camera and then looking away. Exactly. He'd done live. He'd done listening to the talk back and watching the studio manager and talking to the camera. He had some skills that most of our people just didn't have and couldn't possibly have developed in the short time that they had. Unbelievable, really, that we got away with it.
We'll rejoin Mike Smith downstairs. Mike, are you there?
Thank you very much, and thank you to the double act from the other side as well. Now, I've got with me here Roger Taylor of Queen, who's come down from Wembley. We've seen so many bands come and go at Wembley this afternoon and again at Philadelphia this evening, and there's these band changeovers going on. How difficult is it getting all that equipment changed?
Very. Well, you've seen lots of bands come and go, but you're not going to get rid of us that easily. Actually, it's very difficult because the sound, you just don't know what it's going to sound like, you know. And it sounded awful to us on stage, but the audience was just incredible.
They were great.
Wonderful.
Well, the Sunday papers are full of it. We'll maybe take a look at those before we go off the air today. But let's now just go back to Wembley this afternoon, because you too did an absolutely stormer of a set, as did many other bands here this afternoon. But Paul Gambaccini caught up with Bono of U2 for an interview. Here they are.
Bono, great to see you after a dynamic show today. My question is, do you think this is a new era of responsibility for rock music?
Well, I suppose rock and roll music's shirked its responsibility for a long time. I don't know, I suppose it's a dual thing, isn't it? I mean, you have a private responsibility and then there's a public one. Like, this is a public thing, and I think there is time for that. But there's also, it must be private. So much of mine and other of the performers here, their lives is so public. And, you know, they would be private about giving or being generous. Like, I'm sure Bruce Springsteen or Prince or people who are not involved today are generous in a private way as opposed to a public way.
For you yourself, are you satisfied that this was indeed a good way for you two to show their commitment?
Yeah, I think this was the time, you know, to be public about it. The thing that interests me, though, about this, and I don't know if this is the time or the place, but, you see, it's the government's responsibility, ultimately. I don't mean I don't care whether Conservative, Labour, or anything. It's the governments of our country's responsibility to look after our money, because we give them money in tax. And it seems to be an either-or situation. Either they invest in life or they invest in death. And, you know, for the cost of MX missiles or Star Wars or offensive defense budgets, we could turn those deserts in Africa into fertile land. I mean, the technology's with us. It is here, you know, it's possible to do it. So what I hope is this, as a public thing, will affect public opinion, which ultimately will affect the politicians and the policymakers.
How did the relationship between the broadcaster and the viewer or the listener change after Live Aid?
Oh, that's a very good question. That's a very good question. I think answering that question in a roundabout way, I think what was... We woke up the following morning thinking the world had changed. It's very odd, isn't it? Because the 1980s we now look back on as the era of loads of money and, you know, Thatcher and Reagan and some pretty tough right-wing, there's no such thing as society kind of politics. And there, right in the middle of that decade, there's this moment where we think, you know what? Bob Dylan was right. The hippies were right. You know, we, the younger generation, I mean, we're all 40 by then or 35 or something, but we, the younger generation, are going to change the world. We can stand up. We can say, you governments are useless, but we, chaps with long hair and guitars, we can feed the poor. And there was, I think, an idealistic moment at the end of Live Aid that made you think, yep, yeah, we're finally in charge. We can do this. Now, in what way did that change broadcasting? Well, the BBC was complicit in that. The BBC allowed these, lunatics who'd taken over the asylum to go on the television and say, give us your f***ing money. I mean, he didn't actually say that, as you know.
Yeah.
But the implication is, I think what he actually said was, f*** that, give us your money.
I think Spitting Image made him say it,
that. They did, yeah.
Mick and David did that video specifically so that you could give something, and it's not happening enough. You know, you've got to get on the phone and take the money out of your pocket. Don't go to the pub tonight, please. Stay in and give us the money. There are people dying now, so give me the money. And here's the numbers.
Let's
read
go
about,
through the way. No, we're probably going to get the address just, first, aren't we?
No, let's f*** the address. Let's get the numbers, because that's how we're going to get it.
I think we're just, as we're doing this interview, we're just a few days away from the BBC's coverage of Glastonbury. And I think Glastonbury, which, I mean, is on the BBC because of a deal I did when I was back in another job many, many years later. But the BBC, as the national broadcaster, goes to Glastonbury and it buys into the vibe of Glastonbury. It doesn't sit there saying, well, there's a lot of people here seem to be having a good time and they seem to be rather left wing. It just, they go along and they take part in it. And I think that was something that the BBC prior to Live Aid had never done. I think it had always commentated, but it had never in quite that way participated.
Is the BBC a changed organisation then because of that?
I wouldn't say it's only because of Live Aid, but yes, it's a changed organisation, my word, isn't it? You know, in lots of very positive ways and a few not so positive, which we might discuss.
Do you want to discuss that now? Or?
Well, we
In what way then? The good and the bad?
I think the BBC now is much more responsive to its audience than it used to be. I think there was a real sense, certainly when I joined, that it was all rather good for you, BBC, and it was all made by people who were educated and probably lived in London, and there was a certain kind of top-down thinking, and some of that has gone away, and we're all the better for that. You know, there is a now an understanding at the BBC that it's funded by a universal poll tax called the licence fee, so it had better produce programmes for everybody. So there are programmes for, you know, like on BBC Three, there are programmes for Spotty Herberts, and there's programmes for intellectuals, and there's programmes for all sorts of people. So I think in that sense, it's a very good thing. I think where the BBC has changed for the worst is that it's not as prone to taking risks. It's become a risk-averse organisation that wants to know how good somebody is before they put them on the air. It wants people to be proven talents in some other area before it takes a risk of putting them on. It would never do Live Aid now because, well, actually it might, because after years of Glastonbury, it's now got a team of people who know how to do that. But, you know, I do think that the BBC now is less likely to say, oh, f*** it, yeah, let's have a go. Which I think, you know, it really did feel it could, perhaps, in those days.
Let's talk about you then. The first time I became aware of your name was in 1980. I'm 16. And my favourite radio programme was 25 Years of Rock.
Oh, Graham, you're the sweetest boy.
No, I listened to the first three or four. Well, 25 Years of Rock was each week for an hour. You concentrated on a year, started 1955, finishing 1979. You played the music, but also audio, usually from newsreels, from the day. And I was fascinated with the 60s anyway. So I'd listened to the first few from 1955 onwards. And then I bought, every week I went to WH Smith's and bought a C120. So I could get the whole show on one side of the cassette without missing the bit when I turned the tape over.
Well, I'm going to have to make a citizen's arrest.
And so from 1960 up until the final one, I had every one. I'd collected them because that was the only, there was no listen again back then.
Not in those days, no.
I had every one. I think the first one in 1960, I think it starts with Kathy's Clown, Everly Brothers. It's certainly on there. I don't know. It starts with that. And it was a real education because all the big events were on there. The moon landing, the Kennedy assassinations, both of them, Martin Luther King, Oswald, and it was the real audio from the events. And I absolutely loved it. And I also loved that you used Oh Well, Fleetwood Mac, as the play-out music. And at the end of it, it said, and 25 Years of Rock is produced by Trevor Down. So every week I heard this name.
25 Years of Rock was researched by Pete Frame and John Tobler and produced by Trevor Down. The series was devised by Stuart Grundy and is a Radio 1 production in association with Billboard magazine.
Do you know, I met somebody just a few weeks ago. He's now working as an exec with the commissioning team at Radio 4. And I arrived for this meeting and I was sat sort of in the comfy area. And she came over. She was called Sharon. And she came over and she said, hello, are you Trevor Down? And I said, yes. She said, oh, I felt like a pop star. She said, your programme 25 Years of Rock is what got me into radio. It's what made me start listening to the radio. And, it was a moment that there are very few moments, are there, in radio, you know this, where you genuinely feel, okay, well, I did something that people appreciated. A lot of what we turn out is just twaddle to fill the time. But when somebody bothers to say, I really appreciated your work, that's a fantastic thing.
At first, just go sleep. Turn the wider shade off.
Black America is continuing its long, hot summer. Just days after the rioting in Newark, New Jersey, mob violence has broken out in the Motor City, Detroit. Dozens of people have already been killed, and federal troops have been ordered in to restore calm.
The great manufacturing city that exports cars all over the world was in the grip of mad destruction. So were many other American towns. Harlem, New York's Negro Quarter, began to emulate Detroit. Rioting here is no new thing, but New York's police feared that this one might dwarf anything known before. All over the country, law-abiding people looked to the president for a lead. But Washington was a long way away. For the moment, it was a battle, authority against crime on the rampage.
Law and order have broken down in Detroit, Michigan. Pillage, looting, murder, and arson have nothing to do with civil rights. They are criminal conduct, and the federal government in the circumstances here presented had no alternative but to respond, since it was called upon by the governor of the state and since it was presented with proof of his inability to restore order in Michigan.
We have to understand violence is necessary because America made it necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. Violence is as American as cherry pie.
You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose, and our love become a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire.
Oakland, California, where demonstrators against the Vietnam War tried to close the Army Induction Center. 91 were arrested when some of them tried to block the entrances. Some 240 people were jailed within 4 days of demonstrations in a week of nationwide protests, which ended with a giant rally in Washington. Police moved in quickly to carry off the sit-down protesters. President Johnson denounced the irresponsible acts of violence and declared that American policy in Vietnam would not be changed.
I believe that many people in the United States believe that the war in Vietnam is a stalemate. And I would like to assure you that it's not a stalemate at all. And we are winning the war militarily.
I would expect the percentage rate of American casualties to go down in 67. I would expect the conventional military war to achieve very sensational results in 67.
Al Capone, guns don't argue.
It really was it was like an ultimate advert for radio, because it was the music, and you'd blended the music to fit the stories. Usually, you know, the Vietnam stuff would, it was also the actuality from these amazing events in history. It really was.
Well, there was an executive producer on Radio One whose name was Stuart Grundy. And Stuart, whose son Julian is now a commissioning exec at Radio Two, Stuart used to go on air quite a lot. He had a very good voice, very plummy voice. And he was my boss. And he had developed this idea of making the story of popular music with some clips from the year in question. And he did a deal with Billboard magazine in the United States. The idea being that this would be a Radio One show that would be full of American material, so it would be broadcast in America, and also Billboard would be able to supply some clips, because they would know people who collected archive material. So a producer was allocated to this, and they made a pilot. And Stuart was the presenter throughout. So it had links. It had, that was Kathy's Clown, and meanwhile, the Cuban Missile Crisis was going, that kind of thing. And for some reason, I heard this, and I listened to it, and I thought, this is absolutely terrible. And I want to do it. So I went to see Derek Chinnery, who was the presenter, the controller of Radio One. And I said, Derek, I know this sounds utterly pompous, but I could do this a lot better. because I actually, you know, I did do history at university and stuff. And my big idea is I don't think you need Stuart. I think what you need is to get rid of the presenter altogether. I think I'd just learnt a new word, which was disintermediated.
Wow.
And I probably said at the time, what we need, Derek, is a disintermediated melange of the music and the archive. So he called Stuart in and said, I think Trevor's right. I think he should do it. And Stuart said, well, that's fine, as long as I'm still called the producer. And I said, if you're still called the producer, matey, I'm not doing it. So we ended up with that ludicrous credit, which was 5 years of rock, devised.
Right, okay,
Which I nicked from Desert Island Discs.
Okay.
It was devised by Roy Plumley. So it was devised by Stuart Grundy and produced by Trevor Dann. And it set, you know, so as you know, we then kind of revisited it all those years later and called it Sounds of the 20th Century and made... We remade the original 25 and then made 25 more.
When you did the originals, though, this was pre-YouTube, pre-digital. Oh. It must have been, I mean, you must have been manually editing with blades and...
All that, yeah. Well, Brian Thompson, who is still with us, still working freelance as a studio manager, he was one of the great geniuses, really, in all this technically. But we had to make... everything on tape on those huge great Studer machines. We all of 25 Years of Rock was made in a studio called Langham One, which is now one of the downstairs bars in the Langham Hotel opposite Broadcasting House in London. But before it became the Langham Hotel, it was owned or at least rented by the BBC, and it had studios in it. In fact, the famous Jimi Hendrix session where he sings the Radio 1 jingle, that was recorded in Langham 1. It was a, you know, it's a pucker BBC studio, but of course it was enormous.
Radio 1, you're the only one for me.
So if you wanted to play in a record and two bits of tape or three bits of tape, you had to have arms 20 foot long. And we learned not so much mixing as gymnastics, Brian and I,
by
leaping.
On a multi-track?
No, it was all mixed. No, it was not mixed on a multi-track. So if something went wrong, you had to go right back to the beginning. Wow. So I would go in there and say, look, I've got this idea for the script. And it's, I don't know, it was one I can particularly remember, which was, we'll start with The Kinks You Really Got Me. And then when it gets to the middle, we'll fade it down and we'll put this bit of archive in over it. And while it's playing, we'll segue into All Day and All of the Night, which is in the same key. And we'll come back and there'll be this kind of kink sandwich thing going on. And of course, then you start listening to them. You go, you know what? A bit like Strawberry Fields Forever. It'd be much better if we just slow All Day and All the Night down ever so slightly. Let's just... Just drop that, and then it'll sound much more. You know, it'll just fit together better. Well, those are great and easy now, creative ideas. But when you've got to physically do them with mechanical devices, the whole thing is very different. We used to make loops of sound where we would run, we physically make a loop of tape, and run it round two different machines, so that you could get enough of a loop so that you didn't hear the same sound coming around too often. So, it was very different from, you know, making Sounds of the 20th Century, which, you know, I pretty well made on my laptop.
Yeah. I had no idea. I assumed it was all done on a multi-track.
No.
So it's the Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band of Radio.
We did, rather like them. We did do a lot of bouncing. You know, we'd say, well... let's make this sequence where we have that archive, that newsreel, that piece of music, and then we'll bounce that down, and then we'll run this other thing underneath, and off we go. You know, there was a lot of stuff that could and did go wrong. Because, you know, actually, the most interesting thing, you'll know this from making shows, you make the thing, and you've timed it all to perfection, and you know it has to be 59 minutes 30 long or whatever it is, and you finish it and bloody hell, it's 59:20. You know, how are you going to stretch it? And or it's, you know, it's 60:05, but it ends with a really good moment. And you, oh, dear. So a lot of the time was taken in speeding bits up to make them fit, or having to chop bits out when the music wasn't playing. And, oh, dear, it's all, I go cold thinking about it after all these years.
Well, let's go back to the beginning then. You grew up in Nottingham.
I did.
Which is a provincial town, probably what?
How 100? Dare you? It's God's
I'm
own city.
I'm sorry, what? What, 150 miles from London, 200 miles? Not quite.
It's about 120 miles from London, yeah, in the Midlands, the East Midlands.
It's definitely not London, though.
It is not London.
What kind of a kid were you?
Arrogant.
You were an only child, though.
I was an only child.
So the radio would have been important.
The radio was huge for me because I grew up in a house with no books in it and no television apart from BBC until I was, I think, 14. So I never saw Ready, Steady, Go or those, you know, famous 1960s TV shows because my mother wouldn't have that kind of thing in the house. And we were not a creative or artistic family. You know, we didn't go to the theatre. I'd never been to the theatre till I don't know, I was 17.
You didn't go to Panto as a kid?
Not that I remember, no. I think I might have been taken, actually, to see Nina and Frederick in concert.
Come away where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountain top. I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say, I'm on my way. Won't be back for many a day. Me heart is down, me head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston town.
And your parents ran a shop?
They ran a shop in a place called West Bridgford in the suburbs of Nottingham. You know, and they were, they're decent people. I don't want to diss them. They did their best, but they were not cultured. You know, they thought of the ladies' evening at the Rotary Club as being the height of you know, social life. And the radio was my thing because that was where I went off. They gave me the use of an old Vidor portable radio, which looked like a suitcase, and you had to open the lid to make it work. And that was, you know, that was the way I went through the rabbit hole. You know, that was where I could depart from this, you know, pretty constrained council house life in Nottingham. We did buy a house in when I was about 11, I think. So it was a bit different, but no, the radio was where it was at for me. And interestingly enough, I think not just music radio. I mean, there wasn't so much as there is now. But even when Radio 1 started, I used to wake up and listen to the Radio 4 Today programme every morning, even when I was 17, 18. So I was much more interested in what was going on than I was in just hearing the same records over and over again. The radio shows I liked were Kenny Everett and John Peel and those kind of guys who were doing something a bit different rather than, you know, just churning out the hits.
Welcome to the fastest record show on record.
Hi, folks, welcome to the fastest record show today. We play more records here than any other DJ. With a record here, a record there, flaming records everywhere. Sit back as we're starting right away.
Yes, kids, hold tight to your trannies, as off we go. Yes, friends, the first record in today's show is a noisy, raving steamer from Mop the Hoople.
We got my six-string razor in the sky. I'm waiting
the genius of Kenny Everett, winding up part one of my chat with Trevor Dann. In part two, Trevor talks about why one newspaper in Britain named him Dan the Hatchet Man.
setting up a brand new radio station in London, and a lot more besides. Trevor names names and talks frankly about his greatest successes and failures. That's all coming up in a few weeks' time, right here on London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on Apple Podcasts. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. If you put your phone number in the email, I might call you back. I might Skype you on the show. My email address is graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.